Today on the 21st, an interview with State Senator L.G. Sims, who's long focused on criminal justice reform, about recent protests and calls to defund the police.
Thinking about the profession of policing is what's critical. And that's where, as we have these discussions about what happens with policing in the 21st century, I think that's the critical discussion we need to be having.
Then we'll talk to an independent organization that monitors conditions in Illinois prisons. They're publishing an inmate survey on how COVID-19 is being handled in the Illinois Department of Corrections. And some advice to the class of 2020 from virtual commencement ceremonies at colleges and universities around Illinois. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been more than 2 weeks since George Floyd was killed in the custody of the Minneapolis police, with one now former officer keeping a knee to his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Nationwide protests have continued since a video of the event was made public, including in cities and towns across Illinois. Demonstrators are calling for everything from reform to outright abolition of policing as we know it. State Senator L.G. Sims has been working on issues of criminal justice reform for years, including Illinois' law on police body cameras, passed after earlier outrages of police violence toward African Americans. Sims is an attorney and chairman of the Senate Criminal Law Committee. He represents the far south side of Chicago and a long swath of the suburbs, from Lansing all the way out to Mantino. I spoke with him earlier this morning via FaceTime. Senator Sims, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Last week, you and other legislators held a day of action in Calumet City, part of a series of events organized by the Legislative Black Caucus. What was your goal with those events?
The goal was to bring the community together and hear directly from residents, from business owners, some of the challenges they'd been experiencing following the days of unrest, but also to hear directly from them about any challenges and experiences they were feeling. So we came together, we brought local elected officials, we brought state elected officials, we brought countywide elected officials together to talk about these issues. The governor joined us, the lieutenant governor was there, the attorney general, the Cook County board president, the Cook County state's attorney. So all of those individuals were there, in addition to local mayors and local aldermen and park district members and school board members, but most importantly, the community. So we had a community day of action where we gave away food and we gave away water and we gave away sanitizer, we gave away PPE. And then we had some outreach on the census. We had some voter registration activities going on, but most importantly, we had the engagement going with residents and their elected officials. So it was a great day.
So what I wonder, let's talk about some of the events that you alluded to in your, you know, in your comments there. How would you rate the quality of the job the police have done specifically in response to handling the protests in Chicago and other places in Illinois?
I think that the law enforcement has done a tremendous job under some very difficult circumstances. The actions of one officer, and it's often the case, the action of one colors the entire entire profession, and it paints them all with a broad brush, which is oftentimes unfair because there are some tremendous officers doing some work under some very difficult circumstances. For instance, there were at another one of our events, one of our Black Caucus events, there was an incident where there was clearly, there was an individual who clearly came to agitate the event. And as, or actually during the event, and as he started to get ramped up, he was trying to elicit some type of response from the officers, a negative response from the officers. And the officers present showed a tremendous amount of restraint, but it just goes to show that that not everyone has the callous disregard for life that was shown in the incident with Mr. Floyd. So I, during the incident, I actually ended up stepping between the officer and the individual. And the officer, a smile never left his face. He stayed very, very calm, and you could tell that he understood what the gentleman was trying to do. But again, it just goes to show that there are way more, there are many, many more officers who are doing the right thing than the ones who have a callous disregard for life and or training and or the departmental policy.
You mentioned that, one that sort of, I don't think this is the exact phrase you use, but we've heard this a lot. One bad apple spoils the bunch. But I think certainly a lot of activists I've heard from would say that there's really a cultural problem, right? The warrior mindset or the us versus them attitude that many officers bring to their daily policing activities, particularly in Black and also Latino communities. And I wonder what you think about that.
We want to make sure that law enforcement maintains that relationship and a positive relationship with the communities that they serve. And I think that's the key. The key is making sure that you focus not on the one time something went wrong, but on the 99 times something went right. The time where there is someone is in distress and law enforcement is there, or there's a child who's lost and law enforcement is there. And those are the issues we should be focusing on.
What do you think of this rallying cry we've heard about defunding the police?
Well, I certainly want to know exactly what some believe that means. I understand the reallocating resources to areas where police are not their focus should not be in terms of dealing with mental illness. If police aren't skilled in mental illness training, they are skilled in making sure that a person is safe and they're not a threat to themselves or others. So I certainly understand the focus on reallocation of resources, but at the end of the day, and certainly thinking about policing differently, I think the thinking about the profession of policing is what's critical. And that's where, as we have these discussions about what happens with policing in the 21st century, I think that's the critical discussion we need to be having.
Well, are there any specific policies then, if not defunding the police, which, as you said, is often people will then follow up by saying, well, what we really mean is just sort of reallocating the money into the community or to maybe mental health workers who don't carry guns. What should be done to change the way police operate?
Well, I certainly believe that, I passed back when I was in the Illinois House, along with then Senator Raul, now Attorney General Raul. We passed a comprehensive plan to allow the state to authorize body cameras. And as part of that plan, there was a focus on training in particular. And that, for me, that you get to the root of the challenges that we face by addressing the training and addressing the issues that officers will face on a day-to-day basis. We talked earlier about the military mentality. Well, when you get to the root of what individuals do and what they are supposed to be doing during their shifts, they shouldn't be going into communities believing that there's a war. There are instances and there are situations that need to be addressed. But by the same token, you want to make sure that the mindset is to serve and protect, and that plays out in the training. So if you are able to have scenario-based training that allows an officer to see different situations and address different situations, that's going to be critical. Getting at the heart of what an officer sees before they see live action is critical. And even after they have seen live action, the critical part is not just having training when you're a rookie. The critical part is to have ongoing training that an officer who has then been in live action can then come back into the training room and say, well, that's not how I experienced it, but here's a different way to handle something. And that's when we can get there, that's when we'll really be able to see, we'll be able to turn the corner and see a situation where law enforcement officers are certainly prepared and able to react to different situations differently.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with State Senator L.G. Sims. He's an attorney and chairman of the Senate Criminal Law Committee. One of the ideas you mentioned, former senator and current Attorney General Kwame Raoul, one of the ideas we've heard from him is the idea of licensing police. Do you support that idea?
I do. We have this was an issue that we started talking about as part of the the body camera police reform package we passed several years ago. And as one of the elements of that law was the creation of the Commission on Police Professionalism. And when we start to look at the profession of policing as just that, a profession, that's when we'll have the ability to understand what we're doing and where we're going. And the licensing is a huge part of that. You've got barbers who have to be licensed and attorneys who have to be licensed and teachers who have to be licensed, but individuals who are authorized to use deadly force are not licensed. So I do support that effort, and I'll be working very diligently on it.
Would part of that include sort of a permanent disciplinary record for police officers? I think one of the problems you hear about now and one of the actions that we've seen that Democrats in Washington are trying to address is this idea of an officer getting fired perhaps for being brutalizing people at one department and then going and getting hired somewhere else, and the other department doesn't even know about their background. Would that be part of this approach?
Sure. Another one of the elements of the reform package we passed was the creation of this database that would allow for bad actors to be placed on this database, so that if you have one officer who was department hopping, there would at least be access to those disciplinary records for individuals who are seeking to hire him. We were finding in the Springfield area. Several years ago, there was an individual who had been disciplined, but he was jumping between department, and one of the charges against him was he'd been accused of sexual assault. So there has to be a repository of information to address instances like that, so that management in departments and departments in general have information that they are fully informed about the person that they are hiring when they bring someone into their department. We've got to get to the root cause and the information about who an individual is when they're being hired in that database. And I'm glad to see that Congress included elements of that into the package that they just introduced.
4 years ago, I was covering a meeting at the Illinois State Commission on Criminal Justice and Sentencing Reform, which you were on. And I remember at that meeting that you cautioned that the group's ultimate recommendations to the legislature should be pragmatic. You said the process is also going to be one that it's political in nature, and the policy has to be sound policy for it to be good politics. And you wanted to remind everyone of that. I wonder if you hear a lesson for today in the approach to reforming the police that from what you said then.
I still believe that's true to this day. I'm of the mind that we've always got to be pragmatic. Doesn't mean that, and as I also said at that time, and I say now, doesn't mean that we can't have difficult conversations. We have to have difficult conversations because that's the only way progress is made. But we have to understand and recognize that there are realities on both sides, on the left and on the right. But there's also, you have to be pragmatic about understanding and knowing what's the possible. Are we going to do something that's completely outside the realm of possibility? I don't know. I mean, but you don't know the possible until you have the conversation. So I think I stand by that statement just as much now as I did then.
You know, I wonder, by some measures, Illinois has made significant bipartisan progress toward criminal justice reform in ways that I would have found difficult to believe even 10 years ago. You know, a huge reduction in the number of people getting admitted to were being sent to prison every year, the election of a progressive, reform-minded prosecutor in Cook County, legalization of marijuana, and more. I wonder, why do you think policing has not been a part of that progress, or maybe you think it has?
Well, I think we've made strides in policing. Are we finished? No, we still have a long way to go. I think we are, as we continue this reform discussion. That's the beauty of the reform discussion. It's a journey. It's not a destination. We are still in the midst of it. There were some who believe that when we passed body cameras, that was the end and everything was going to be okay. And that's not the case. Illinois is, however, it's a model for the nation on a number of issues, as you mentioned, from the criminal justice reform measures that we've already passed. I'm proud of the reduction in violent crime that you're seeing, and you're seeing the individuals who have criminal backgrounds being able to go back and get gainful employment. So there, we have made significant strides, but until we get to a place where everyone feels safe and everyone feels comfortable in their homes, we've not reached our true destination, and that's what we're fighting for.
State Senator L.G. Sims represents the far south side of Chicago through the suburbs from Lansing all the way out to Manteno. He's also chairman of the Senate Criminal Law Committee. Senator Sims, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
As ever, we'd love to know what you thought about our conversation. Send us an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Coming up after the break, a conversation about how the Illinois Department of Corrections is handling coronavirus disease. That's just ahead here on the 21st. Stay with us. Listening to the 21st, I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air this morning, 409 people, including both incarcerated individuals and staff, have been diagnosed with COVID-19 in the Illinois prison system. While businesses begin to reopen across the state, visitation is still prohibited in Illinois' 27 prisons. Now, a new report from the John Howard Association has found that almost half of the inmates they surveyed said that they had received no cleaning chemicals from the Department of Corrections to clean their cells. That survey covered a week-long period in late April, early May. Jennifer Vollenkatz joins us now. She's executive director of the John Howard Association of Illinois, an independent prison monitoring organization that goes inside correctional facilities to observe conditions there. Jenny, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you so much.
And Lee Gaines is also with us. She's been reporting on this for Illinois Newsroom. Lee, thank you for being with us as well.
Glad to be here.
And as ever, you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. Again, our number is 800-222-9455. Lee, I want to begin with you. Can you describe what you've heard from inmates about what the conditions have been like over the past few months? What are people dealing with?
So I've been talking to a few people incarcerated in Stateville Correctional Center, Menard, and also Logan Correctional Center, which is a women's prison in Illinois. And what I've been hearing is mixed. I would say, generally speaking, there is an underlying current of fear that people are experiencing. I think they're worried about contracting this disease, and they're worried that the Department of Corrections doesn't have the healthcare capacity to adequately care for them. They've also described, you know, issues with getting supplies to clean their cells, getting enough soap. I've heard, you know, some people are getting a small bar of soap on a weekly basis. Other people have told me that, you know, they need to pay for that soap. There's also issues with access to water. Some inmates have said that they have brown water in their cells coming out of the tap, that they don't feel comfortable drinking it. And they also, you know, have complained about the quality of the food that they're receiving as well. So that's just a kind of a sampling of what I've heard from people who are incarcerated, as well as their loved ones who are really worried about them.
What have you been hearing what sort of steps have inmates been taking on their own to try and keep themselves shielded from COVID-19?
Well, they've been getting really creative. So, you know, I've heard from loved ones of incarcerated folks that their loved ones are using laundry detergent to try to clean their cells, because they're not really getting much else to clean them with. And that's also laundry detergent that they have to purchase from the prison commissary. I've also heard from someone I spoke to in prison that, you know, he takes a rag and he kind of covers it in soap. And sometimes they get this diluted bleach water from staff at the prison, and he, you know, dips the rag in that so he can take it to the yard when he goes to make a phone call. He'll wipe down the phone with that because he's worried about the phone not being sanitized in between uses. And then other people are just trying to use a bar of soap to clean their cell, which I think is pretty difficult.
And Leah, I also understand it can be difficult for family members and friends to be able to get in touch with their incarcerated loved ones right now. Have you been hearing that from people you've been speaking with?
Yeah, I have. I think part of this is due to the fact that the prison system has been kind of jockeying between lockdowns and administrative quarantine. And what that essentially means is that people's movement inside these facilities has been limited. So because of that, they have limited access to the phone. I've also heard that video visitation has been canceled with no explanation, and that people have really struggled to schedule those video visitation visits. And as you said at the top of the show, you know, people can't physically go see their loved ones who are being held inside these facilities. So it's really a video visit or a phone call that is their access to their loved ones.
All right. Jennifer Vollenkatz with the John Howard Association. I want to bring you into the conversation now. Can you talk a little bit about how less communication can lead to less information getting out, and I guess the converse of that, less information getting in to the Department of Corrections, and maybe how that informed, you know, why this survey might have been needed?
Right. So much like what Lee just reported, you know, we were hearing a lot of similar things. We were getting letters and a lot of phone calls and emails from loved ones and family members, and some information coming directly from people who are incarcerated. And communication is definitely an issue. I mean, look, some of these issues are problems on the best of days. So I Sure. think we need to recognize it's not as if we've got these things perfected inside the prisons in Illinois. You know, communication is regularly a complaint that we get, or lack thereof, from people who are incarcerated. But during COVID-19, when the department is trying very hard to limit exposure and contagion, keeping people in their cells is one of the mechanisms they have used, which means people have far less access to phones and video visits, which is an enormous problem. It takes a toll in so many ways, people feeling disconnected, even more depressed. You know, we know this has an impact on people's mental health. And we know that for family members and loved ones, it takes what's already, you know, a very worrisome situation and makes it, you know, even more so, because they can't hear from their loved one what's actually going on. They don't know whether their loved one is sick or not. They don't know if they're getting the treatment they need or the items they need. And they're fairly powerless to do anything about it, which is, you know, an incredibly difficult thing to manage.
And Jenny, can you tell us, so talk a little bit about this survey. What jumped out at you among the results?
Sure. So communications is actually an area that helps shine a light on why we felt the need to do this survey. First, I think it's important to understand that the John Howard Association does these surveys on a regular basis on general conditions and treatment inside Illinois prisons. But the way we do it is different. typically we send our surveys in advance of a visit when we go in ourselves to observe conditions and talk to the people who are most impacted to find out what's going on inside of each prison. And we make those results available. We have never done the entire prison system at one time. So this was a really huge undertaking for us. And I want to be clear that we are still, you know, we are at the beginning of the analysis, not the end. I think there's still a lot we can learn from the information we have and information that's still coming in. But the reason we felt the need to do this is that there is obviously a whole new set of protocols and policies being implemented and being made available on the Department of Corrections website. And our question is, how are these things actually being put to use? What does implementation look like? Because a policy on paper doesn't mean a whole lot, particularly anywhere in the justice system. So understanding how it's being translated, how it's being implemented, whether it's, you know, according to the intent or not, is critically important to understanding how people in our prisons are experiencing COVID-19, what's being done to protect them and to treat them, and what we can learn from all this going forward to improve system functioning.
And What did the survey have to say specifically about how many inmates are getting soap and other sort of cleaning products that they need?
Sure. So we sent in enough surveys for pretty much each person who is incarcerated in the Illinois Department of Corrections. We did not send it in to the Stateville Northern Reception and Classification Center because we don't believe they have ready access to writing utensils. And so we didn't want to create more frustration. So almost everyone had an opportunity to take the survey. We got an overwhelming response, close to 49% of the incarcerated population.
And can we pause on that? Like, what is the usual response rate for one of the John Howard surveys? I mean, is that typical, or is this?
Yeah, they're pretty good, frankly. We routinely get over 30%, if not more. However, we're doing it facility by facility, not the entire system at
sure.
once. So sometimes, and it's typically in advance of a visit. So I think that there is a connection to people knowing we're going to be there in person within a few weeks and filling out the surveys. And the other thing I should mention is when we do it that way, our typical method, we collect the surveys ourselves when we're inside the prison. So there's actually an opportunity for someone to see us and say, oh gosh, I didn't finish yet. Can you come back in a few minutes?
Yeah.
So seeing us in person obviously creates, you know, a different set of circumstances in terms of people completing or responding to our surveys. This was totally done by mail. We had to send them in, and then we provided pre-addressed, prepaid envelopes marked privileged, because we are privileged mail recipients from the Department of Corrections, so people could feel safe sending us back their responses.
And
so
does that, just to be clear, that means that, I mean, does that mean that the department can't look at the mail before it goes out?
Correct.
Okay.
Like, it should be treated similar to legal mail.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Which is something that's really important to us, because we need to make sure that the people who share information with us don't, you know, aren't being put in the position of having to fear retaliation for sharing their thoughts and concerns with us.
Okay, so what's as we look at some of the specific, and I should remind our listeners, if you're just tuning in, I'm Brian Mackey. This is the 21st. We're speaking with Jenny Vollen-Katz. She's executive director of the John Howard Association of Illinois. We're also speaking with Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines about a new survey from the John Howard Association about the conditions in Illinois prisons. As always, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So specifically on this question of cleaning products,
sure.
Based on the survey results, do inmates feel like they have what they need?
Right. So if you take the system as a whole, based on the responses we got, you know, about 35% of our respondents said, no, they didn't have enough soap to regularly wash their hands. about 61% said, yes, they did have enough soap to wash their hands. Now, for us, one of the interesting things we think that we need to look at more carefully, and we do this in our survey results, and we'll be doing it even in greater detail over time as we continue to analyze the data and read the thousands of comments that came in with the surveys, you know, is figuring out how does that break down among facilities? Because one of the issues we have routinely in Illinois is that each prison functions fairly autonomously. So even if a policy is system-wide, it doesn't mean it's being implemented the same way throughout the system. So understanding, you know, which prisons got the higher response rates, where did people report that they were getting enough soap, and where were they reporting that they did not, and understanding, you know, looking more closely at the specifics there, and breaking down that information even more finely so that we understand exactly where the fall down was. Was it the DOC didn't provide the soap? Was it that staff didn't communicate what was available? Was it a supply shortage? Was it, you know, what was it? Because I think those are some of the issues that are critical to really changing our system. Is, you know, is understanding what went wrong, what didn't go right, where was policy not put into practice as it should have been.
Sure.
You know, which truthfully is an issue that we are seeing throughout the entire criminal justice system right now, right? I mean, I think that's why oversight exists, to address actual behavior.
Right.
You know, what is the conduct? What are the outcomes? You know, the policy on paper doesn't do a whole lot if the conduct doesn't match, if the implementation isn't with fidelity and as anticipated by the policy.
Sure. And it seems, I mean, if for people who aren't familiar, the Illinois Department of Corrections, it is one agency, but each prison warden can kind of operate his or her own fiefdom to some extent. And Lee, I want to ask you, I understand you spoke with an inmate directly about this topic of cleaning supplies. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, so I spoke with Joseph Horton. He is incarcerated at Menard Correctional Center. He's in his late 50s, and he has been in prison for about 16 years now. And we have some tape of him talking about, you know, his access to cleaning supplies in his cell.
The little bleach water that's watered down that they give us to clean the cells, you know, other than that, that's it.
Yeah, that must be difficult to sanitize a cell, you know, with a bar of soap.
Yeah, it is. It's very difficult. And like I said, the watered down bucket of water or whatever they give us to clean the cells with is basically water, you know. And you put it in a bottle, and it doesn't. You don't have any smell. Just like just using plain water.
So, Lee, as someone who's been reporting on COVID-19 in prisons, I mean, I wonder if, you know, based on what you've been hearing from people, were the results of the survey at all surprising to you, or did it seem to pretty much fit?
No, the results of the survey were not surprising to me. I think they really lined up with a lot of the reporting I've seen. And I think Jenny made some really important points, which is that, you know, a policy may appear one way on paper, but the way it's implemented can look very different from prison to prison. And I think that that's true of what I even heard from loved ones. You know, some said that, you know, their loved ones were housed in dorm-like facilities, and they did have occasional access to things like hand sanitizer, for example, whereas, you know, other people said they have no access to hand sanitizer. And it really, it depends on the facility. And I think it also depends on who's working in those facilities, and are they being held accountable to the same standard? So I think that that's a really important point, that there seems to be a lack of consistency across the board.
And Lee, we've got less than a minute left here, but I just want to ask, what do we know about, before we have to take a break, I should say, we can come back to this conversation, but what do we know about what DOC has done to minimize exposure to COVID-19 and treat those who've been infected, Lee?
So as we mentioned at the top of the show, they have stopped visitation, so people can't bring the disease. Visitors cannot bring the disease into prisons. And then they're also supposed to be passing out soap regularly to people who are incarcerated. And they are also, they tell me, spraying incarcerated individuals' hands with hand sanitizer throughout the day, like before meals, for example, or when they leave their cell to go out in the yard. But, you know, from my conversations with incarcerated people, that is not always happening.
Okay, that's Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines. We're also speaking with Jennifer Volen-Katz, Executive Director of the John Howard Association of Illinois. Both of you, please stick around. We have to take a quick break, but we will continue our conversation about conditions in Illinois prisons related to COVID-19. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, my guests today are Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines and Jennifer Volen-Katz, Executive Director of the John Howard Association of Illinois. They've been telling us more about how the COVID-19 pandemic has been handled and perceived inside Illinois' prison system. Before the break, we were talking about access to cleaning supplies for inmates in the prisons. And Jenny, I think I had to cut you off there. We were running out of time. You had something to say about this, though.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, we at the John Howard Association always have something to say when it comes to prisons and surveys. I just wanted to sort of circle back on something Lee mentioned and that the gentleman who she interviewed, who's at Menard, also brought out that I think points to the importance of our survey results and other questions that we need to be asking. So about close to 46% of people responded that they did not get cleaning chemicals from IDOC to clean their cell in the last week, which is very concerning. And close to the same number of people, close to 45%, also said that they didn't have enough cleaning chemicals, to thoroughly clean their sleeping area in the past week. And I think that this raises a whole bunch of issues, not just access to cleaning supplies and need to have them in terms of, you know, reducing exposure and contagion, all of which is true. But a few very specific things that came out in, you know, emails and letters that we got and comments that people attached with their survey responses. Number one, we think there's some misunderstanding about what cleaning supplies are and what's mandated by the CDC. So according to the CDC guidelines, you know, bleach can and should be diluted as a cleaning supply. So one of the things we pointed out to the Department of Corrections is they should be making very clear to people what the CDC guidelines are on that and what they're doing to comport with them so that people have an idea as to what to expect, and then they'll have a better gauge as to whether or not the cleaning supplies they are receiving when they're receiving them are adequate or not. So, you know, there are some pieces here that point to communication failures. And we need to sort of correct those before we can fully understand what's going on and what's going wrong. The other thing this points to is the access to the cleaning supplies. So not only do, you know, have a significant number of people reported that they don't have access, this prompted us to look more closely at sort of what that actually looks like. And one of the things we started to see repeatedly was people reporting that when cleaning supplies were being made available for cleaning their cells or common areas, it was often first come, first served. And so cell doors would open and there would be a mad dash to the staff desk to get them, which is really not, you know, how those kind of supplies should be handed out, nor is that a good way to ensure that everybody's getting access to them, you know, in order to make sure that more areas are being cleaned more thoroughly, more often to reduce the spread of the disease.
So, Lee, you've been reporting on efforts to donate sanitizer to the Department of Corrections. Can you tell us a little bit about who is responsible for that and why they are now raising questions about their efforts?
Yeah, so this is a group of prison educators, so people that also teach in colleges and universities across the state, and previous to the pandemic were teaching inside prisons. They felt at the beginning of the pandemic in late March, early April, you know, they went to the Department of Corrections, and because they were no longer able to see their students, they still wanted to help. And so the department said, you know, if you want to do something helpful, you can donate hand sanitizer to us. And so they took that really seriously, and they ended up donating 710 gallons of sanitizer. And just for a cost, if you want to know how much that's worth, that plus about 50,000 or more than 50,000 bars of soap ended up totaling almost $50,000 worth of sanitizer and soap donated to the Department of Corrections.
But just to pause briefly on this, Lee, just because I think it's so interesting, they also had to buy bottles, right? Because you can't just get little Walgreens-sized bottles of sanitizer. You get it in, like, oil drums or whatever.
Yeah, huge drums that they picked up from distilleries, a distillery in Chicago and a distillery in Peoria. And so they also had to purchase 14,000 bottles and also labels for each one of those bottles so that people using the sanitizer knew what was inside of it. They also had the sanitizer formulated so that it wouldn't just sanitize skin, it would also sanitize surfaces. I think that their hope was that people could use this inside their cells. But what the Department of Corrections has told me is that inmates are not allowed to keep toxic chemicals in their cell. I think they are concerned about this, people drinking the hand sanitizer and becoming seriously ill as a result. But anyway, I've been talking to inmates to really ask, you know, have you received the sanitizer? And so I talked to Joseph Horton, who we heard from earlier in the show. He's incarcerated in Menard, and here is what he had to say about hand sanitizer.
Do you still not have any access to hand sanitizer?
No, we don't. No, we definitely don't get that.
So no, because I was told by the department that they're having someone come around and spray your hands through the bars. Is that happening?
That's not true at all. That's not happening. No.
Are you getting a bar of soap a week?
We get this bar of soap that's the size of a quarter.
Wow.
That's what they get, was a bar of soap the size of a quarter.
And that was Joseph Horton speaking to me from Menard Correctional Center in Southern Illinois earlier this month.
So we've only got, I don't know, about 30 seconds left, unfortunately, but Jennifer Vollenkatz of the John Howard Association, it feels like our public consciousness is shifting away from coronavirus broadly in Illinois and around the country, at least. But it seems like this is still an issue in our prison. So again, briefly, what do you want people to keep in mind as this situation continues to develop?
You know, I think that this is an opportunity for us to step back and look at the prison system more critically, in terms of, is this serving the purposes we hope that it will? You know, the disease inside prisons there aren't words to really describe the hideousness, right? If it's difficult in any congregant living situation, it is made that much worse by all the different conditions present in prisons beyond just congregant living. And I think we need to look at the conditions inside our prisons, at the treatment people receive, at the outcomes we want, and whether or not any of this is serving the purposes for which it was intended. Because I think we'll see that it is not, that we are putting people in danger unnecessarily. We are not improving public safety. We are hurting all of us. And this disease simply shines a brighter light on all of that.
Jennifer Vollenkatz is Executive Director of the John Howard Association. We also spoke with Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us here on the 21st.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you so much.
Normally at this time of year, graduates of colleges and universities would have already walked across the stage to accept their diploma in front of their friends and family. Most would have been, in a non-pandemic year, packing up to leave campus and set out on the next phase of their lives. But graduation ceremonies and the celebrations that follow looked very different this spring. And like most events these days, they were not held in auditoriums or a quad full of graduates, but over the internet. To celebrate the class of 2020, we've compiled a few graduation messages from virtual commencement ceremonies around Illinois. What you're hearing now is the Western Illinois University Wind Ensemble kicking off the school's virtual graduation ceremony with a performance recorded earlier in the year. Their virtual commencement speaker is alum and Broadway actor Melody Betts. She started by giving advice to graduates with aspirations in show business.
Though things are uncertain, I am here to attest the fact that there is room for you. I promise, this profession isn't going anywhere. And I charge you to find your place in it and be the best first at being you, and then be the best that you can at what you can do. There's someone waiting for you to fulfill your purpose. There is someone out there who needs your presence. You never know how you're going to affect someone, how you're going to impact the world, but it's out there waiting for you, and there's yet and still plenty of room. So get out there and find your place or places. Lastly, life experience is the best teacher and preparer of the human being. So practice being a human being. And by that, I mean be kind, considerate of others. Realize you're not always right. And even if you are, other people have their right to their own opinion and experience. Show up, do the work, and work hard. Respect your fellow man, co-workers. Take care of your mind, body, and spirit. Every action should be led by love if you can help it. And humility and patience go a long way. And always remember, you belong. You're here, so you are worthy.
Class of 2020, the South Lawn at Old Main is strangely empty for a warm and beautiful day in June. I don't see you, but I can feel you. I can feel your energy and your pride. I can feel your passion and your readiness to move on to the next stage of your amazing lives. I can also feel your frustration as you wrap up a spring term unlike any in the college's long history. For a close-knit community like Knox, one powered by face-to-face interaction among people very different from one another, a remote spring term has been difficult. But this I know. We will come together again for the class of 2020 Knox commencement with all the pomp and circumstance you have earned. Today, Provost Schneider and I are here to formally confer upon you the degrees that you have earned, approved by vote of the faculty and the Board of Trustees. This will make it official.
And even though it's not what you expected or bargained for, you embraced the change. Most of you were forced to leave your campus homes, your routines, and your friends with minimal notice, and yet you have persevered. You adapted and navigated through enormous obstacles. You stayed focused and you didn't give up. It is dealing with these types of interruptions to life that makes you tougher and more resilient.
The only difference between hope and despair is that despair shapes an attitude of mind. Hope creates a quality of soul. As you celebrate this day, and I do hope you celebrate, realize that you have acquired far more than a degree or an education. You've acquired wisdom and maturity, or a depth of soul that can only come from struggle that tests our mettle. You are well prepared. Have the courage for a path forward to create your future. In all of this, my wish is that you retain the audacity of hope.
Happiness can be found in the darkest of times if only one remembers to turn on the light. Class of 2020, nothing about this is fair, but there's a light within your reach. You are the most resilient, innovative generation in America.
Don't be afraid. America's gone through tough times before. Slavery, civil war, famine, disease, the Great Depression, and 9/11. And each time, we came out stronger. Usually because a new generation, young people like you, learned from past mistakes and figured out how to make things better.
You've just heard messages to 2020 graduates from former President and Illinois State Senator Barack Obama and U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. Earlier, we heard virtual graduation speeches beginning with actor Melody Betts at Western Illinois University, followed by Knox College President Teresa Amott, Bradley University President Gary Roberts, and Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at Illinois State, Diane Zoski. And that is all the time we have for today. But before we go, I want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. We've been hearing interesting things from listeners, and it is informing our coverage. Join us by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, the word is TALK to 217-803-0730. The 21st is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Our intern is Zany Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.